Hello, everybody. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. The NBN is run by volunteers, but it also has considerable expenses. In order to continue bringing you the in-depth author interviews that you count on, we have to pay our bills. So we'd like you to consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the network. It's easy to do. Just go to any NBN page and follow the donation link. Since we're part of Amherst College Library, you'll be taken to an Amherst College Library page. Go to the NBN line on that page and follow the instructions. That's it. From all of us at the network, thanks for your support.
Hello, I'm Alejandra Bronfman, and this is New Books in Latin American Studies. Today, I'm speaking to Kevin O'Neill about his new book, Secure the Soul, Christian Piety and Gang Prevention in Guatemala, just out with University of California Press. As the subtitle suggests, O'Neill's book is an ethnography of the profound and often surprising connections between notions of Christian piety and multi-million dollar programs aimed at state security through gang prevention. O'Neill takes us into unexpected sites and venues, including call centers and reality television, and conveys in searing detail the often unsettling ways in which programs informed by notions of Christian piety aim to convert and transform former gang members in Guatemala City. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Kevin. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Your book is a really fascinating and often harrowing ethnography of post-war Guatemala and the role of what you call Christian piety. So can you tell us a little bit about how you came to be an anthropologist and when you knew this was going to be the subject of your next book?
Sure. No, absolutely. In terms of how I became an anthropologist, you know, I have about 12 different stories about how I ended up being an anthropologist. What I think I'll go with right now is that I was for a long time a student of philosophy and theology, particularly of Latin American liberation philosophy, as an undergraduate and then as a master's student. And I hadn't even taken an anthropology course up until I think it was my second year of a master's program. But when I did, it was a seminar on language and culture. I found this really exciting window onto both politics and active fieldwork and theoretical concerns. And so while I've had a kind of a longstanding interest in questions of religion, anthropology allowed me to explore that in really empirical ways. Ultimately what that did was it motivated me to apply to anthropology programs and immediately get kind of linked up with questions of religion and politics, mostly in Latin America, because I'd done a bunch of community organizing and traveling in Mexico, like during the late 90s and the conflict zones of Chiapas, a lot of human rights advocacy. So the anthropology seemed to be like this natural connection between some of my political interests and theoretical concerns and intellectual projects. That's how I kind of ended up as an anthropologist.
And what about this particular project?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this project – so I actually wanted this – this is my second book. What I actually wanted this to be my first book. So when I was I came to graduate school to my PhD program thinking that I would do work on religion and politics, but maybe in Mexico, maybe in the United States with undocumented immigrant communities. But then I had an advisor suggest that if you're really into religion and politics, you should go to Guatemala. And I already been several times for different research projects, and I visited it and mostly stayed in the capital city, which is now this has kind of changed in recent years, but for a long time, Guatemala has been a place of anthropological research, but mostly outside of the capital city. There hadn't been a ton of work done in the capital, and when I arrived in Guatemala City, I found myself completely excited and connected to the capital, thinking that there were just, and I really think so today, just continually endless projects that excite me in the capital city. So I was torn between these two kind of book projects, one about the rise of neo-Pentecostal megachurches in post-war Guatemala and their impact on the formation of citizenship. Now, that would eventually form my dissertation and my first book called City of God. But during that, especially during the later kind of the almost 2 years that I spent doing field work for that first book, what emerged quickly was that it wasn't just democratization and citizenship that was defining much of Guatemala, especially the capital, but questions of security and gang violence. And I remember there was this really important point before my first kind of long stay of almost 2 years for fieldwork, where I was kind of pivoting between this first project on mega churches and this other project on Christian interventions and gang life. And I just felt like the mega church project would ground me in kind of the Christian landscape of the country and allow me to engage the gang prevention security project better once I finished the first one. So this book, Secure the Soul, has been in the works since the very, very beginning of my research, but I only really had time to turn to it during the second year of that first long stay.
It's interesting that it's the other half of the first project, and I can see now how those two fit together really well.
Yeah, very much. I mean, I consider the two. I also have this one advisor, you know, she was like, you know, you could either write one gigantic book or you could kind of follow through with some of these questions in a second book. Because the first book is really about City of God is really about how Guatemalans imagine themselves as citizens and practice their citizenship through Christianity. How do they become better and more kind of connected to the nation? And the second book, Secure the Soul, is really about the dark underside of citizenship, which is delinquency. And how do Christians wrestle with people who prove themselves either not be able to be better or who don't want to be better. And then within the Guatemalan context, that's largely that question's related to questions of gangs.
Yeah. So, Mateo.
Yes.
The book centers on him, and it's also about much more than him.
Right.
Who was he, and how did you meet him? Or who is he?
Yeah, who is he, right? I think about this a lot. I mean, so Mateo, the guy I call Mateo, there's a larger kind of theoretical conversation we could have about, you know, does the person that I call Mateo and Mateo, the character in the book, are they the same person? I'll stick with kind of the person I call with Mateo at this moment. Mateo is a someone who was born in Guatemala. So he reflects a larger kind of story. He was born in Guatemala during the Civil War, and him and his father left for the United States. And they, when Mateo was about 3 years old, and they moved to Los Angeles and had a predictably difficult time settling in. And this is Los Angeles in the 80s and the 90s, where there's a rise in gang activity with Mexican, Asian, African American gangs. And what you see is the emergence of these Central American gangs in Los Angeles, most notably Mara Salvatrucha and Barrio 18. These two major gangs emerge in Los Angeles among Central American immigrants. And Mateo is a part of this history. Now, U.S. history tells us that, you know, following the L.A. riots, there's a shift in deportation policy, and Mateo got wrapped up into that also and was sent back to Guatemala along with tens of thousands of other Central Americans who were either convicted or at least accused of gang activity. And so what Mateo is as a character in the book is a constant point of reference about the really local and intimate histories that are a part of this larger movement of refugees from Central American wars that go to Los Angeles and then are then shipped back by the thousands after a shift in deportation policy in the United States. And what we see in Guatemala, as well as in El Salvador and Honduras and a bit in Nicaragua, is a rise in gang culture, what is largely LA-based gang culture. And the effects are tremendous in terms of violence.
And I guess this touches on something that you mentioned just a moment ago, but you say in the introduction, I think it is, that Mateo really is the argument of the book.
Yes.
Yeah. When did you realize that? And how did you come to that formulation?
Yeah, I mean, this is a larger kind of ethnographic statement that I'm trying to make, in the sense that there is a way in which the book is structured. There are five kind of classic ethnographic chapters, and in between are these interchapter moments where we follow Mateo and learn more about him. And we can talk about Mateo's relationship to the chapters, but what I didn't want the reader, and the reader, of course, is open to interpret all this as he or she wants, but what I would not want the reader to do is something that Mateo kind of adds a sense of texture or color to the book. But what Mateo is doing is articulating a fundamental argument that the book is trying to advance, that the actual ethnography is the argument and not just evidence. And we can talk about how, but that the larger argument is this question of being better, is this larger question of Christian piety, which is fundamental to Christian theology, but it has also become a central component to Central American security.
I want to talk about that, and I also want to talk about the organization of the book, which I found really compelling. But first, I wonder if we can back up a little bit and talk about the very close relationship and the powerful presence of Christian institutions in post-war Guatemala, sure. Just as a background.
Yes. I mean, what the one thing that is amazing, I mean, what's extraordinary for me, what I continually have to remind myself is that, you know, Guatemala was for centuries, it was a longstanding Roman Catholic country. But up until 1976, really, there's an incredibly Roman Catholic country. But after that, following an earthquake on February 4th, 1976, we see a dramatic shift in religious affiliation, such that Guatemala is today, many reports, 60% Pentecostal or charismatic Christian. Now, there's a very specific history to this, where the earthquake ushered in or at least attracted U.S.-based Protestant aid agencies, and the Roman Catholic Church at the time did not believe itself to be an aid organization, and so a vacuum was created. There's tremendous and kind of definitive histories of how Guatemala became such a now a charismatic and Pentecostal Christian community, or at least nation. But what's central for me intellectually as I continue to work in Guatemala and think through this question of religion and politics is that when we think about civil society, when we consider civil society in Central America, especially Guatemala, Christian organizations, meaning Pentecostal and charismatic organizations, are oftentimes the leading institutions and organizations that encourage citizenship participation or respond to things like gang violence. They are the defining institutions in a place like Guatemala.
So that actually leads into the question of organization and the way you chose to center the chapters on these different sites, which are in some ways you wouldn't think you would find the church in a place like a reality TV show or a rehab center or even a prison. But you do. And it's a really so I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about how you chose to organize it and especially the interspersing of the interludes of the life with the bigger chapters about each of these specific. It's as if you're kind of wandering around the city and stopping in at each of these places.
Yeah, it is a bit of a wandering. I mean, I think the organization is really important. I mean, there's one way you could take this kind of intersection of Christianity and gang prevention. I mean, there's this incredible book called Homies and Hermanos by this guy, Robert Brenneman, who and actually, you know, Bob ended his research just about as I began my research. And one of the things I forgot to say earlier that kind of sparked this interest in this topic for me was that not just because Christians respond to things like gang violence, but because for a very kind of distinct window in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, there was a moment where these two large gangs, MS-13 and Barrio 18, allowed active members to leave their gangs if they converted to like Pentecostal and charismatic Christianity. It was this very strange window into an affiliation that's usually for life. Now, Bob followed this, but by the time I got on the scene, that was long closed. But what happened was that there was a real rush afterwards of Christian aid organizations that kind of filled the vacuum. So what I quickly understood was that, you know, this isn't about necessarily converting people out of gang life. I did not see that. Over the 8 years I did my research, I did not see that a great deal at all. Not enough to form a book. Bob did, and the book is a real success. But what I did see was a rising number of deported gang members and a growing kind of local gang population that found itself interacting with different kinds of prevention schemes, really, that were very limited. Many of them were explicitly self-presenting as Christian. For example, chapter one in the book is about prison chaplains, and these prison chaplains enter maximum security prisons in Guatemala City and outside the capital also, and engage with active gang members, trying to convert them out or trying to convince them that gang life is not great. But then there are other not so explicitly Christian, but I think definitively pious programs to convert people out. So you mentioned chapter two engages this. I mean, there's another way to say it. It's like absurd reality show. The scheme to get people out of gang life. They take these in Guatemala City in around roughly like 2005, 2006. USAID funded a reality television program that took 10 former gang members and tried to make them little mini entrepreneurs. They aired the shows. They ran a classic reality television show, which involved these kind of confessional moments and this before and after makeovers. And I mean, beyond the fact that this kind of reality television show was thought up or cooked up by self-professing Christian aid workers, the actual kind of mechanics of, for example, a reality television show has deep, deep connections to Christian kind of imaginations of a before and after. So the makeover moment where the ex-gang member takes off his kind of gang apparel, like baggy pants and white t-shirt, and then is suddenly in these like proper slacks and a button-down shirt that hides his tattoos, connects deeply with missionary histories about wearing your Sunday best and dressing up for church and having your exterior reflect your interior. So what I try to do in the book as I move through these chapters is, of course, engage some of the explicit Christian moments where self-identifying Christians are engaging in Christian activity to help these gang members, but also thinking about the larger security apparatus, this rise of prevention and intervention, and the kind of Christian imperatives that it traffics in. So that's how I've kind of organized the chapters in a way.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about each one of them because they are they're so fascinating and they provide such interesting contrasts, but also these very compelling similarities. So prison.
Yes.
The description of the prison is really tragic in a lot of ways and hard to read for me anyway.
Yeah.
It seems like one of the most unlikely places to find pastors, and particularly respected pastors, right? I get the sense reading it that they actually have some legitimacy in the work that they do there. And as you pointed out, it seems like everyone else has abandoned those spaces except for the pastors.
Yes. I mean, what's interesting, I mean, I'll be in Guatemala in 2 weeks to complete a report that me and two colleagues are completing on drugs in the prison system in Guatemala. And what, you know, I continue to find as I continue to engage the prison system in Guatemala is a complete lack of access to rehabilitation services or any kind of therapies whatsoever. These prisoners have certainly been abandoned, and this whole entire system is now working at 270% capacity. One of the prisons that I reference in the book is at 570% capacity. I mean, these are extreme situations, and pastors are one of the most consistent resources for these prisoners, hands down. The entire system has about 21 different entire prison system has 21 different prison structures and has, I think, 17 psychologists on staff. I mean, for 18,000 prisoners, it's a dire situation. But when you have a steady flow of charismatic and Pentecostal pastors entering the prison system, most of them not even registered with the state. They just come in on visitation days, totally voluntary, and working with these prisoners, it is the lifeline for these prisoners, absolutely.
The TV show and the call center, you could read those together.
Yeah.
Chapter two is about the TV show. Chapter three is about the call center. And you can read them both as kind of efforts to instill discipline through clothing and consumption and behavior and links to capitalism, especially, right, to make good workers. And it's really interesting the way that capitalism aligns with piety. Right. And it seems to me that what you're arguing in part is that Christianity is not necessarily a set of theological beliefs, or not only a set of theological beliefs, but also a set of embodied practices.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's a semiotics to converting that, again, this dynamic between how one presents oneself on the exterior is supposed to reflect what is existing on the interior. I mean, one of the most challenging predicaments of, for example, gang prevention, which is about really what has become in Guatemala about connecting with individuals, is not only trying to connect, which is this really amorphous kind of task, but also to establish some kind of metric for connecting. I mean, these are programs that are usually funded and want some sort of metric or response. So how do we know that people have changed? This is a classic, I refer to Augustine a great deal throughout my work, but and this is a classic Christian predicament of, so change is extremely important, change for the better, before and after, but how does one actually document that? And in chapter 3, like you're referencing, one of the most important kind of rising industries in Central America are bilingual call centers. Not many people might know this, but it's called nearshoring, and that's when an organization, I mean, like Coca-Cola or UPS or Norwegian Cruise Line, when they want back office support, they'll go to the Philippines and India, but they'll also pay a little more for Central America because the time schedule is usually in line with North America, but also because Central Americans usually have a great affiliation with North American culture, so it's actually easier, better service in some ways. And these call centers have been hiring by leaps and bounds deported, oftentimes gang members from the United States because their English is excellent, their cultural command of U.S. their command of U.S. culture is great, and also the visuality of call center work is none. As long as your accent's on point, it doesn't matter if you have tattoos on your neck or your face, or it's just not important. So a number of institutions, along with the call centers themselves, have been trying and continue to recruit deported gang members to work in call centers. And it's become this kind of life raft because it provides a really solid middle-class salary to people who could otherwise not enter the formal economy in Central America.
There's this great image in your book of the people who run the call centers just hanging out at the airport.
Yeah,
waiting for people to get off the plane.
Ugh, it's tough. I mean, so there are two repatriation flights every single day entering Guatemala City. 30,000 people return to Guatemala, so they're deported back to Guatemala every single year. So there's usually two flights, and because of the geographical placement of the airport and the high rises that house the call centers. They're quite close to each other. they're quite close to each other, and in terms of recruitment, the call centers have just taken to showing up at the tarmac and waiting for the deportees and seeing how many of them are potential recruits. And in some ways, you know, that's like really, I mean, kind of in my most cynical moments, like, man, that is so predatorial. That's terrible. But in fact, these guys get off the plane. Like, if you think about Mateo, the central character, he got off the plane. He left Guatemala when he was 3 years old. His Spanish was terrible when he landed in Guatemala City. He went straight to his cousins outside of the capital. He grew up in L.A. He had no idea about non-urban living, let alone in Guatemala, let alone in Spanish. While it is quite predatorial in this kind of neoliberal capitalistic moment of like just like trolling tarmacs for talent, those who do meet the qualifications are super happy to engage. It is a real opportunity for many.
Yeah, it's a situation that's rife with irony somehow.
Oh, absolutely.
It seems to work on so many different levels.
Well, yeah, because you know, so the call center oftentimes asks these deported guys to pretend that they live in the United States. And so, you know, here's a country that had no use for example, Mateo, until they deported Mateo back to Guatemala and asked him to pretend he lives in Nashville to service, you know, the clients of UPS. It's a pretty, in that sense, it's a super rough story.
So the final two chapters contrast more programs that are more surprising to me. One is the program of sponsoring children
right
from afar, and in some instances help them, And then the final chapter is on the Pentecostal rehab programs, in which former gang members get dragged in and held pretty much against their will, and in what you describe as prison-like settings, right? So the language of conversion or transformation is really strong in the people who create these programs. And what surprised me was the extent to which the targets of the programs, the people who are receiving the benefits or not of these programs, also start to adopt this language of conversion and transformation.
Yes.
Did that surprise you as well?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, so chapter four addresses or explores a child sponsorship program, which many are probably fairly familiar with. If you give, let's say, $32 a month to support, to contribute to the education and maybe the life of a young child somewhere else in the world, it's super popular. It's a huge industry. It's like a $4 or $5 billion industry globally. I mean, the question of, what I think you're kind of referencing is that, so ostensibly the child sponsorship program is to sponsor a child in an at-risk part of Guatemala City to keep them out of gang life. But in fact, it's not just the change in the sponsored child that the program really emphasizes, but also the change in the sponsor, him or herself. So I go back and forth between sponsors in North Carolina, middle class, professional, six-figure kind of families that support these at-risk children in Guatemala, in one of the most difficult parts of Guatemala City. It's a community at the bottom of a barranco, which is a canyon. These canyons cut Guatemala City. They were part of the land grabs in the 1970s, 80s, during the capital's urbanization, and become the roughest parts of the city, largely because they not only exist at the very bottom of these canyons, like 200 meters down, but also they're just kind of well beyond the reach of the state. The police never come down there. The infrastructure is light. So you have these really well-intentioned North Carolinians who are sending the $32 a month to support at-risk children in these barrancos. And what they're doing, perhaps predictably, is trying to cultivate a greater sense of self also while trying to help the child.
The difference between the children who do receive help and the ones who don't is pretty striking.
Yeah, it is super striking. How to explain it? I talk about it through the language of segregation, in the sense that and research two things surprised me in terms of previous research on child sponsorship. One, there's not a ton, which is, I thought, completely surprising in terms of ethnographic research on child sponsorship. The second is that the research that has been done quite rightly identifies the bright distinctions that form between those who are sponsored and those who are not. And those generally, for example, research that was done in the 90s emphasized that one child would have more toys, another child have no toys, or one child would receive letters, another child not receive letters. And that would disrupt community politics, which I think is a very real concern. And the child sponsorship industry knows this and has a long conversation about it and about the perils of it. Child sponsorship industry, I said, it's a $4 or $5 billion industry worldwide, has such momentum that it's able to kind of experiment at the margins to see, like, what can it actually accomplish beyond just a development project or charity? And one of those things is security. And so while it takes tremendous gusto and a kind of great sense of optimism to enter a community that is really ignored by the state, that has been left at the bottom of a barranco to kind of fend for itself, and where gang culture has really taken over, while it takes great gusto to engage that, those distinctions that form become even brighter. So it's not just that one kid gets a letter and one kid doesn't, but that one kid really has an opportunity, quite possibly a possibility, to cultivate themselves and get a job or to move forward, engage school, and the other not. And the consequences can be quite dire between that, the division between sponsored and not sponsored.
Yeah, that was very striking to me. And so in the chapter on the rehab programs, it seems like it's almost the opposite dynamic, right? Where these people who have really been abandoned or left behind, as you say, are being worked on in these kinds of ways that seem very problematic and not so effective in a lot of ways. But then there are some examples, and you give one in the book of that having some kind of an effect. And I was really interested in that the moments that you were able to find where the people actually started to believe all of these things or started to live in a way that reflected the kinds of things that they were being told about getting out and leaving their habits behind and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, the fifth chapter addresses the rise of these Pentecostal drug rehabilitation centers, or just Pentecostal rehabilitation centers. And a lot of that has to relate their expansion has a lot to do with the rise of gang violence and drug culture in Guatemala City. But principally speaking, these are houses or former factories or apartment or abandoned apartment complexes that have been renovated in the name of kind of a Christian theological style of rehabilitation. And so this is very much about people being picked up and dragged into a house and kept there for oftentimes months on end. This is a genre of captivity that one can find in Mexico and Ecuador and Brazil. It's a very strong presence in Guatemala City. And what we see in this book, in my book, is that these centers, although they are extreme violations of human rights. I have a report that I wrote for the United Nations Commission on Human Rights and its Committee Against Torture about these centers. While they're incredible violations of human rights, they're also important community resources that serve as kind of that allow families to warehouse their problematic child to figure out what to do so that he is off the streets. And while they're inside the center, they become the subject of these of Christian logics that if you really want to exit, ever leave this center, you need to be a proper Christian. And that means, and this returns to kind of the themes of chapters 2 and 3 or the reality television show and call center, that one needs to properly perform a pious subjectivity. One needs to sit up straight. One needs to engage in sermons. One needs to be a proper Christian. So this kind of engagement in Christian piety, as I call it, is oftentimes a last resort of trying just to get out of these centers, just trying to convince the pastor and your family that, look, I've changed. Let me out of this this holding cell, basically.
I think that there's a tension. I want to talk about the tension in this book that I see as running throughout, really, and that's between your descriptions of some of these situations, which are really absurd and absurdist, right?
Yes.
And the reality TV show, especially, but a lot of these seem that way. But there's also a kind of faith in people and a way of giving people a chance who haven't had a chance before, or at least a recognition that in some ways the programs humanize former gang members as no one else is doing.
Yeah. Right?
And so you seem to walk this fine line between critiquing some aspects of these programs and also recognizing your effectiveness.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be, I often think about, you know, this, I completed this research over 8 years. I think about whether, and constant travel, so about a year straight and then 3 months a year. And I think about, you know, what if I just did in a classic anthropological moment of just doing a full year, and that's kind of the gold standard. You go somewhere for a year and never did kind of the continued work. Maybe I'd have a harsher critique and just kind of kick down the door and say, like, look, this is, you're locking up people in these old warehouses. You guys are, going into these gang tanks in the prisons and you're just preaching at them. And this reality television show is completely absurd and these call centers are predatorial. But I think what the longer engagement allowed me to see was that none of these are ideal. None of these interventions, and a lot of them are absolutely, I mean, like, The reality television show is probably the one that I am the most critical of in my heart, because of the 10 original, I think 7 have been murdered. And of the 10 original participants, I believe 7 have been murdered, largely because of their affiliation with the program, which is reckless kinds of interventions. But at the same time, it's hard to ignore the that a call center gives to a former gang member. It's absolutely hard. It's impossible to somehow erase those interviews and those long engagements with people who find real dignity with even with these rehabs. I mean, I was just transcribing some tape this morning where this pastor makes this really great argument. He's like, human rights. I remember the conversation while also he's like, human rights. What are those? Why? But, you know, what about the rights of the mother who now can sleep at night because she knows her son is safe in this rehab and not roaming the streets and going to get killed? So it is a fine line between critiquing the logics that underlie prevention, gang prevention in Guatemala, while also appreciating that these are efforts at just making do of trying to survive what is ultimately a perfect storm in post-war Guatemala, with the rise of organized crime and a shift in the transit of Andean cocaine that now most all of it goes through Central America, as well as the rise of gang culture because of new deportation regimes in the United States. It's put Guatemala in an absolutely terrible position, and what these efforts at intervention and these gang prevention programs represent in some ways is at some points an honest effort at helping people, while at the same time having oftentimes horrific consequences.
I think the fact that you don't shy away from that tension, that it remains central to the book, is one of the things that gives the book its power.
Thanks. And I think also it connects, I mean, at the core, so, you know, if the listener's like, yeah, this book is everywhere, like it's at the rehab, it is at the prison, like this is a bananas book. The thing that is organizing this at the very foundation is the story of Mateo, but it's also, because Mateo is the argument, because the argument is that Christian piety is this continual effort, failed effort at trying to be better. It sits at this core of a Christian worldview where sin places the human being, this is kind of a Christian anthropology, but sin places the human being apart from God, and that the human condition is this consistent effort to return or get closer to God. And if Christian piety, as understood by Augustine, is this kind of mandate to always try to be better but always failing at it, then these programs in Mateo, they all animate this kind of larger principle, which I call Christian piety, that itself organizes gang prevention. I mean, like, me myself, I don't have any confessional stakes in this game. Like, I'm not a professing Christian. I grew up Catholic. Now I'm not, etc. I'm not really committed to this. But what amazes me is that this multi-billion dollar gang prevention industry, underlying it all is this kind of notion of it is this notion of Christian piety of we need to make these people better, and it's going to be a failed effort, but we need to keep on trying.
Yeah. This is a story mostly about men.
Yes.
Is there a female counterpart?
I wish. I mean, it's this is a book about men. And so this is for two reasons. I mean, one is because, I mean, I started this research, God, how old was I? I don't know how old I was. Like, I started this research for this project when I was like 27 or something like that. So look, I mean, just in terms of the actual, my access in terms of ethnography, I had really good rapport with men. I was living in California at the time, at least based in California at the time, because these guys largely came from California, and we had a good rapport. It was all right. The second is that the industry does target men over and above women. Now, I think the child sponsorship program is the only one that cuts it 50-50 and actually deals with women. The prisons are overwhelmingly male. I think they're like 4% female. The rehabs, of the 200 that I know of and kind of I engage in with my study, although I focus only on three ethnographically, only one of the 200 that I know of are all female. So these programs target men over and above women by far. So that's how it ends up being a book about men. What am I to do?
It's not. I didn't mean it as a critique. I just was observing it.
No, it's a total critique. I mean, I'm like, why is this about men? You know, like after year three, why is this only about men? Year six, why? But there was no legit. I mean, and anyway, I invite engagement about like how could this have been legitimately engaged with women equally? But I mean, I think I was in the middle of writing this essay about development and security and how if you paint in broad strokes, like. Development interventions in Guatemala are overwhelmingly about women. So especially like microlending. They ignore men. So and in United, at least in Canada, there's this really important program about investing only in women, or at least young women. And this is a certain logic. But security is dominated by the idea of the delinquent male.
Yeah. It makes a certain amount of sense.
I guess. Yeah.
And in that regard, I actually thought about Philippe Bourgeois and In Search of Respect when I read this book, not just because of the method, but also because of the ways both books are really attentive to themes like masculinity, dignity, respect, and work. And so I was wondering if your book is a kind of response to that book in any way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Philippe's work is phenomenal. I mean, In Search of Respect was a pivotal moment for me in terms of reading it. It's it is an extraordinary piece, and his later work is, of course, excellent also. I draw a lot of inspiration from In Search of Respect and the idea of focusing in on particular characters and being concerned with my reader and the kind of response my reader might have. Now, the themes themselves are also really parallel, as you mentioned, with questions of masculinity. He has, In Search of Respect, he has an excellent chapter. I think it's called Going Legit, where he talks about his main informants trying to engage office culture. And, you know, I couldn't help but return to that kind of material when I was thinking through, for example, the call center industry. I mean, so much of these interventions across the five chapters is this, I mean, to ask someone like, I mean, Mateo, who has an extensive prison history in the United States and is himself quite proud and has a tremendous kind of street swagger, to ask him then to kind of phone and to take, I mean, there's no other way to describe it, like take total shit from North American customers is such a difficult thing to ask him. It's such a difficult thing for him to accomplish. So, and the same thing with the reality television show. I mean, to ask someone to give up their gang culture inspired clothes for like a pink button down Oxford is a lot to ask. And so, a lot of the Christian piety has a great deal to do with masculinity and about reforming masculinity. And largely because I think gang prevention as an industry is absolutely obsessed with the delinquent male and with these questions of masculinity.
Is there an end to your story?
Yeah, I mean, there is an end to the story. The way the book ends, yes. I mean, the way the book actually ends in the conclusion is that Mateo, who we've come to know through these interchapter moments as his life in the United States, within prison, his troubled deportation, his efforts to try to make a go of it in Guatemala City as working for call centers or helping out with the child sponsor program or finding himself in rehab. He is trying to figure out what he's going to do next. And all of these kind of prevention programs have kind of allowed him to reach the age of 37, 38, which is quite surprising to him and quite surprising to me. But at this kind of time in his life when the book is ending, there's not an obvious next step. The prevention industry is not the development industry. The prevention industry is trying to get people out of gangs, maybe get them a job. But in terms of what happens to deported gang members when they hit middle age, when they've kind of aged out entirely of these prevention industries, that they're not in prisons, they can't be kind of connected with the prison chaplains. They don't necessarily belong in rehab. And as with Mateo, he kind of burned his bridges with the call centers. What's next? And we find Mateo at the very end of the book in a pretty precarious position about wondering, well, what is next? And it's not obvious. And that's how I kind of end it.
Right. And it's interesting that you make the point that that's actually the intended outcome in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's the intended outcome in the sense of, yeah, I mean, tell me more. Tell me more.
Well, in the sense that he has come through all of these programs successfully, so he's not in them anymore.
Yes.
But there's no other plan, and that's sort of the end of the line in terms of engagement with the plans, right?
Yeah, no, it is absolutely the end of the line.
It's an interesting way to end, and thought-provoking, really.
Last chapter of City of God was called Disappointment. Now I've kind of gotten in this rut of like ending on a downer note, but yeah, I mean, what I wouldn't want to show is that, like, and now Mateo is middle class and he, cause that's, I mean, empirically not true,
right.
But it's also, one of the kind of intentions of this Christian piety, that structures the security apparatus, is to distinguish between those who are worthy of help and those who aren't. And those who aren't really fall off the grid, and Guatemala City is a violent city with one of the highest rates of homicide in the world. And those people, over the years, I've seen increasingly bad decisions and end up in increasingly bad situations and end up dying. Now, Mateo has proven himself to be a proper kind of, at times, subject of intervention and prevention, and like I said, continued to live up until 37, 38, and onwards. He's still alive. That next step in terms of now what is not obvious. Only a third of Guatemala works in the formal economy, and to be visually he's still very much visually a deported ex-gang member, and it's in terms of, this is when we return to like Bourdieu, like his habitus, like his gait, his style of sitting, his accent, he can't but be within the Guatemalan society categorized as deported. It's extremely hard to figure out what the next step is.
So I've taken up a lot of your time today. Maybe we can just close by telling us what your next step might be in terms of new research.
I have two next steps that I'm kind of trying to do right now. So the first is that I'm continuing with the rehab research. So chapter five looks at a kind of a quick view of this network of informal drug rehabilitation centers. Now, during that research, which I started many, many years ago, I came across a great deal of information about the first such rehabilitation center in all of Central America. So I'm writing an ethnographic history of the center, because it really has connections to all the other centers in the entire network. So I'm working through, as kind of like the final moment of this larger question of religion and politics, I'm looking at the question of Christianity and drugs. So it's democracy, security, and drugs, and so on. The second book project is not nearly as advanced as the first, but I'm in the middle of it, and it's on clerical sex abuse. And what it looks at is, you know, so much of the debates on sex abuse in the Catholic Church is nation-based, in that you have the U.S. scandal, the scandal in India, the scandal in Canada. But in fact, there was a great deal of movement of predators across borders. And what I'm looking at is a pretty consistent pattern of North American predators moving to Latin America, either moved by different dioceses or move themselves to escape prosecution. So I'm looking at kind of the transnational history of clerical sex abuse, focusing mostly on Latin America. So those are the two kind of major projects.
I'm intrigued by both of those, and we'll look forward to seeing more about them. Thanks so much for talking to me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
No, thank you.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Latin American Studies. See you next time.